Okay, so it is Friday, December 7th at Steenbach Library, and my first question is if you could just spell your first and last name.
Sure, it's Christina, C-R-I-S-T-I-N-A, R, middle initial, and then Mondragon, or Mondragon, is M-O-N-D-R-A-G-O-N.
Great, thank you. So if we could just start with a brief description of your early life, where you grew up.
Sure. I grew up in Racine, Wisconsin. I was born and raised there.
Great.
And went to Catholic school from first grade till eighth grade, public school after that, and lived on the south side of Racine.
So how did you end up matriculating at UW?
My mother graduated from here with a bachelor's and master's degree. And two of her siblings.
Okay. And so what did you study at Wisconsin?
At first it was just general, but then I ended up with secondary education, social studies major, and under that it was history, women's history. Well, actually it was, not women's history, although I did a lot of that, but under the program, because it wasn't a department at that time, of women's studies. I have an undeclared major in women's studies, but under history, it was Latin American history and immigration history.
Why did you choose these areas of study?
I thought it would help me understand my background better. I mean, yeah, I've been to Mexico a gazillion times, but my parents really never spoke about the actual history mm-hmm. of Mexico and being Latin American. And I was one of the very, very, very few Hispanics or Latinas on mm-hmm. campus, even in law school. And I just wanted to, I guess, be knowledgeable about my culture, my background. Not necessarily my culture so much, because I got that, but the history mm-hmm. of it all. And my brothers and I were asking questions about certain historical events, and why we ended up with the parents we did. You know, what brought my family, we children to the university, basically, to college, and when there weren't, if any, other Latinos mm-hmm. or Hispanics going to school at that time, going to college. We knew we were lucky in high school, mm-hmm. but we didn't know what, we knew from our familial background what happened, but we started to really realize why we were kind of more I don't want to say special, but why we were the first, I guess, to Hispanics to go on to college other than my mother and her mm-hmm. family.
That's great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Were you involved in any campus organizations when you were here?
Well, I matriculated in 1969, mm-hmm. and that was my freshman year, and I quit. Well, I was expelled my sophomore year because I didn't make the grades because it was no one went to school anymore. we were protesting, we were having fun. It was just not the time to go to school, mm-hmm. and for a lot of us, and my fiance and I were my sophomore year, we were really involved with each other, and trying to establish that relationship and where we were with school and what we wanted to do, and attendance was just really poor, and so I didn't I was not accepted back for junior year. But that was okay because we got married, and then he came back and went to school, and then when we got divorced, then I went back to school, and then that's when I finished. So I had, mm-hmm. 69 and 70, and then I returned in, I think it was 76.
Okay.
I could be wrong about that, but.
So what prompted your decision to go to law school then?
I was in secondary education, and I did my student teaching. I did an internship out at one of the junior high schools out on the West End. And I was kind of not happy with what was going on in the classroom even then. Mm-hmm. It was kind of ugly, really. And then I student taught at Madison East, and I didn't want to do a traditional American history class because, first of all, I didn't study that, and I wasn't interested in that. I was more interested in Latin American history or women's history, and that wasn't being offered. So I took the necessary courses to student teach African history and Black studies at Madison East. And I was paired up with a really, really neat teacher. And then at the end of that semester, I graduated December then, at the end of that semester when I student taught. But I could tell that I was not going to be a good teacher. I was having a good time with the students. Mm-hmm. And, whether they learned something or not, I'm not sure. But there was an incident between a boy and a girl, and the boy really liked this really cute little redhead girl, and he was always giving her a hard time because he really liked her, and she, I don't know if she understood really the dynamics there, what was going on, but he went too far, and it was right before Thanksgiving vacation, and the kids were kind of like crazy anyways. That last day, and he went too far. He said something, and so she took a folder and hit him over the head, and I started laughing. And so I thought, no, teachers really shouldn't be laughing at incidents like this. We should know better. But I was having a really good time with the students, and teaching what I was teaching, but I just really didn't feel I had these enough of an authoritarian personality, even though I do like to push people around and I just didn't feel I could do that appropriately with children. So I really started looking at more policy issues. And then unfortunately in January, my youngest brother passed away, and so that really devastated me. And so I didn't want to do anything. I got a job right away on campus, and so I did that for a year before. I don't know. All of a sudden, I was being recruited to go to law school, and I thought, yeah, because that's they're policymakers. Lawyers can be policymakers. So I thought that would be a better fit. I tried going to a master's degree program and took a course, and I really, really, really liked it. It was really cool. I really loved it. But then law school came calling, and I thought, okay, I'll give that a try. I think when I was 10 years old and watching John F. Kennedy get inaugurated, and we were in a Catholic school, so it was a big deal. He was a lawyer, and everybody made a big deal about him and being Catholic, and so that kind of got me interested in being a being a lawyer, but not a practicing attorney. More again on the general policy making arena. So that's why.
What was the course that you were mentioning? If you remember.
I don't remember exactly the name of the class or the course. I do remember which has lasted me all these years, and I still have my original copy of The Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Oh, wow.
And as a matter of fact, I was doing some volunteer training with Planned Parenthood, and somebody from Brazil was there, and she did a whole 2 hours on Pedagogy of the Oppressed and tying it in with what Planned Parenthood was doing, and that was just last year. So it still applies, and it was, you know, fabulous just learning,
yeah,
you know, was what he had to offer, mm-hmm, in terms of, again, taking another look at my cultural background and how I didn't fit into society all that much.
And you mentioned before when you were in the schools, like, I think you said the word ugly. Can you specify a little what you mean by that?
Yeah. It's interesting to hear teachers talk about how bad, you know, really violent things are, especially in Racine and Milwaukee Public School. My mother was a teacher for, you know, ever since she graduated. That's what her major was secondary education. And I don't think she ever experienced that. Mm-hmm. And when I became a lawyer and started working in the Kenosha, in Kenosha County, I had a lot of her students come up and tell me how wonderful she was. You know, she mm-hmm. was a sweet, wonderful woman and great teacher, blah, blah, blah. And so I had that view of what teaching was going to be all mm-hmm. about. So when I did my internship out on the West End in junior high school, they're junior high school kids, the girls were so mean and passing notes, and this teacher, he was oblivious to it all. And the boys too, they were just really rough kids. Mm-hmm. And for a West End school in Madison, thinking back on that now, and then I hear teachers complaining about how things are, I'm like, nothing's really changed all that much, except now kids are carrying guns or whatever. But there were drugs and alcohol at that time too. I mean, this was the late 70s. You know, it was out there. But yeah, I did not like the disrespect mm-hmm. by especially the girls. They were really mean. Really mean girls to the teacher. And I don't really think he caught on, but if he did, he hit it pretty well.
Yeah.
I had plenty of opportunities to discuss things with him afterwards, and I really couldn't even bring it up. It was just so uncomfortable to bring it up, because if he didn't know, I don't want to start telling him now. I mean, he's been, had been doing it for, you know, a long time. And so I didn't feel it was my place to tell them really what was going on there. But they were passing notes and just telling secrets to each other and talking and interrupting him. And, you know, it was bad. In high school, the boys, there were some who were physically very immature. And, you know, they would start, you know, hitting on people. And then, like I said, there was this incident, you know, with this really cute young girl, and this, you know, he was a bigger guy, and you could see he came from more working class families, and she came from probably a very well educated family, and the dynamics there at Madison East was very easy to see that, the tension, but the boys at the, you know, especially set their sophomore year, they're, you know, some boys were just really, really having a hard time physically sitting still. They were making trouble. Mm-hmm. And now they would be labeled. And so it was pretty rough. Mm-hmm. It was pretty rough. I'm glad I didn't do it. I don't know what I would have done. You know, I mean, you know, my mother had a certain way, but I think she was oblivious too to a lot of things until she started taking students to Mexico, and then she could see that the girls were pretty bad. And when she taught in an all-girls school, she wouldn't let me go to an all-girls school because the girls were mean.
Okay, I see. So what did you do following graduation, your after law school?
After law school?
Yes.
I got hired pretty quickly by Legal Action of Wisconsin, so I did poverty law for 7 years. And they have offices here in Madison, too. And then their lawyers practice in the surrounding counties on the southeast side of Wisconsin. The main office was, and I think for both Madison and Milwaukee, southeast Wisconsin, the main office is in Milwaukee. And so they had then an office in Kenosha. So that's where I practiced, was there. Then I represented people in Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties.
Okay. And how did you, so are you currently in family law right now?
Yeah, I do a lot of family law.
And you have your own practice?
I do have my own practice.
When did that start?
That started, ironically, in the Bush era. it's interesting because I've been thinking about this with his funeral, is that I remember his administration, but mainly, I don't know, Congress or senators, wanting to defund Legal Action of Wisconsin. And then watching him on election night in his hotel room with his family, and there were his grandchildren crawling all over him on the couch. And I thought, I think about that now, and I think about really what a tremendous family man he was, and he had a lot of really positive ideas for society. And at the same time, he's wanting to close down a poverty law center. Mm-hmm. And so I had a very hard time with my boss accepting the fact that she was very, very suspicious about, she was always on the lookout for defunding. And so she expected that we were going to, the lawyers, well, what happened was that the senators or congressmen, or congresspeople, mostly men at the time, they would send somebody in to sort of like talk to us about legal action and trying to ferret out what was bad about legal action so that they could defund us. And I get that she was, being protective about that, but she was being protective about other things as well. Homosexuality was not viewed as being, people were not out in the open, and my boss was a lesbian, because she's still in practice. And so there was that whole scare about being found out, and that would be used against us and not being funded. So I was feeling very uncomfortable with that, and a new manager that we had, which is a sign of the times here, she had children, but most of us didn't. Mm-hmm. The rest of us didn't. I think she was the only one who had children. And she expected us to pick up the pieces for the fact that she needed to be home with the kids. I'm like, people come in to legal action and want me by name. Why can't I do this in the private sector? Mm. And so so I thought that I would do that. Plus, legal action was very geared to doing appellate work, changing laws, which they did. Mm-hmm. And they had some really excellent lawyers on staff who were very good at making sure some laws were changed. But I wasn't like that. Mm-hmm. I liked being in court. And they didn't, that was the rub. I liked being in court, they wanted me to do more appellate work or mm-hmm. getting ready for appellate work. And I'm like, no, I'm winning this case in mm-hmm. court. That's all there is yeah. to it. And so with that, I established my own reputation outside of legal action. So I thought, you know, I'll just go into private practice. Now was the time to do it. My parents were very supportive, both financially and personally. And so that's what I did.
Were you able to practice or litigate more in your?
That's all I have been doing.
So what kind of work have you done, and has that changed at all?
It has. I did a lot of divorce work, custody evaluations, financial, litigation in the realm of family law, and I did a lot of Social Security disability work, which again is appearing in front of a judge and winning your case there. And then in private practice, I did some criminal law and public defender work. And I really, really liked that. And I'm very, very good at doing what's called Terry stop motions or probable cause motions. Making sure that when you're stopped, it's for a legitimate reason. And so within my first year, I won a big, big case where I caught, a police officer basically discriminating against my guy who was driving a car, and he's African-American, and his girlfriend was sitting in the passenger seat or in the back. I can't remember the facts that well. And her father happened to be a police officer. And there was a police officer that saw my client driving her car, and he didn't see her in the car. And so he knew the car because he knew the police officer, her father. And he stopped him for absolutely no good reason except that there was a black guy driving a car mm-hmm. that was supposedly not his.
So you did a significant amount of public defending?
And for about 5 or 6 years, I did until... there were a lot of gangs in Racine. All of a sudden, it just...
Wow.
And then if they didn't get what they wanted, they would turn on you and report you to the bar for ethics problems for one reason or the other. And I didn't want to waste my time trying to defend myself about what I did or didn't do for this guy. So I stopped doing public defender work for a really long time, but I really liked doing outside of public defender work. I did some drug cases. And again, I liked doing the preliminary stuff
mm-hmm.
and winning at that level
mm-hmm.
and avoiding any other litigation. Mm-hmm. So it's good. So I'm back to doing public defender work now.
Oh, wow.
And so that's what's changed. I'm doing more of that, and then a lot of family law yet. But what's changed in family law is that there is a mediation group, and I feel that that's really the proper way to deal with especially custody cases, but mm-hmm. when people are trying to break up their finances also. It should be mediated and stay out of court because everything is public for public information anyways.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't make any sense to make it ugly. Mm-hmm. So I want to be doing that kind of work.
I see.
So I'll change. So I'm slowly changing in that direction, doing a little bit more public defender mm-hmm. work, doing a little bit of Social Security disability work, and not doing a whole lot of civil law anymore. I used to do a lot of landlord-tenant cases, that kind of thing. Or I would, lawyer friends of mine would send a case over that, needed to be litigated. Didn't matter what court it was.
Mm-hmm.
If they would give me the basic facts and materials and set mm-hmm. the case up, I loved going to trial. So, I did that for a while.
Okay. Well, so then I guess we can move into your time at UW, if that's all right, and start from 1969.
Yay. My reunion comes up our 50th anniversary comes up next year.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Yeah, we're preparing for that now, and I think a lot more people are getting more excited about it now.
Yeah, there's a lot to be nostalgic about, I guess, and
yes,
to
there
not
is.
Be. So can you describe the campus climate when you first got to UW and your first year as a freshman?
My reaction or what it was like?
Both, if that's all right.
Okay. What do you want first?
Let's start with your reaction.
My reaction? It was the most exciting thing you can ever imagine to come to a university like this and have absolute freedom. And so many different people. Mm. So many different people. However, in the dorms, and one of my friends, she's on call in case I need a memory check here on this. But I was talking to her because she came on campus our sophomore year, January, our sophomore year. She mentioned this when we were talking. There was a substantial Jewish population, and I worked for Jewish families in Racine. My brothers and I did, and my grandfather had a lot of dealings with the Jewish entrepreneurs in Racine, and so they gave us our first jobs. So it was kind of interesting what a natural fit that was, because there were so many Jewish girls or young women on campus at that time, and so it was very comfortable but very exotic at the same time, because they were all from out east and from very wealthy families. And I wasn't used to that and climate, and then on the other hand, I'm picturing my dorm, Chadburn, a very big Chinese population or Asian population, but they, now in recall, knowing more, I'm thinking it was a very substantial Chinese student population, and then from the small towns from around Madison. Mm-hmm. Those of us who came to Madison from Racine, we were pretty spread out, but my graduating class, 69, we were not nice to each other. It was very competitive. I went to Case High School, and it had just opened up, and I started there my sophomore year. Mm. And we were my year, 69, was the first full graduating class. So there were people coming from every direction in Racine, and because they were being moved out of, the two other high schools in Racine into Case. And so there were already a lot of people there, where most of my friends were from my Catholic grade school and my neighborhood. So when I came here, I was not in touch with very many people from Racine at all, except my high school boyfriend. He was at Ogg, I was at Chadburn. I could see his dorm room from my floor, which that didn't help. And so it was rough. I mean, it was exciting, but it was rough to find yourself, and yet very exciting because of the freedom from your parents, and then just what was going on at the time, because they were breaking down all sorts of barriers.
Yeah.
And Chadburn, the dorm system, went autonomous from the university, so that we wouldn't have to live under curfew rules for number one, and boyfriend rules number two, because my brothers and my father were not allowed on my floor at the time, at my freshman year. And so all of that was really changing, and it was only the men's dorms who were allowed to have beer parties. Mm-hmm. Women's dorms were not. So my floor, and I was president of the floor at that time, or house, it was house, Murray House. We had the first beer party, and a sanctioned beer party, and then we invited my my ex-husband's house to, I'm hoping he's on call too, to tell me, because I forgot the name of his house, to come and party with us. And so they did, and then in comes, off the elevator comes Dan, and I knew him from the summer. I didn't know him exactly. We really didn't talk to each other. But we were both taking courses during the summer at Parkside, and his class was right down, a couple doors down from where I was taking class. And so we recognized each other right away. So then we were together our sophomore year right away. Mm-hmm. But our freshman year, my freshman year, the other thing that stands out, not just the freedom, but really how simple life was. You know, we had telephones in the room, and we could call out, you know, and call anybody, you know, and the dorm was going to pay for it. The dorm paid for our food. Judy and I were going through that. She said, I don't remember the food that much. She said, I suppose, you know, I don't know how it got paid. Did we have tickets? And I'm like, no, they just gave us food. You know, that was it. And you know, it's just very, very simple. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was something else that just escaped my mind here. The first thing was kind of neat, because the upper class women, they try to make it a welcoming atmosphere for the freshmen. Mm-hmm. So they had a record player, because, well, in my house, I couldn't get a record player. My brothers got a stereo, but I didn't. And the boys had stereos, and the girls had record players, and they were playing the Fifth Dimension, The Age of Aquarius, because that's pretty much what it was. You know, and Janis Joplin came freshman year to play at the have a concert at the Coliseum, and we went up to the higher floors at Chadburn to watch all the traffic go in and out. And then two of the women in our on our floor in our house, they went and came back, and they were just higher than a kite at all levels, and telling us about it, but they could barely tell us about it because they were so high. And so, yeah, I think one of them started growing marijuana plant, and there was a problem there for her. And so, yeah, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were just so exciting for us. Very, very exciting. Mm-hmm. So those are the things that really stand out in my mind, but just, you know, State Street being available to us, and mm-hmm. the moratorium, the huge demonstration that was going on all over the country, mm-hmm. if not the world, or Europe, I should say, anti-war demonstration. And being a part of that, going mm-hmm. up State Street and being a part of that, and hoping my parents wouldn't find out, mm-hmm. because, you know, you're freshmen, you think, well, and my mother did. She went to school here, so she knew professors here, and they all loved her because she did very well. And so, yeah.
So you were involved in types of campus activism?
Yeah. Yeah, not a lot, but okay. Yes. Oh, the other thing that really stands out was spring after Kent State, after May 4th. Mm-hmm. And that was the National Guard on Bascom Hill, and me going to a class. And a lot of classes were shut down at that mm-hmm. time, too. But, and, you know, young men like me and having a rifle and knowing they could shoot me.
So you went to class that day?
We didn't know about it until later. And so then, I think it was the day after, or 2 days after, I was up going up Bascom Hill, and they were there. And it was sad, really mm-hmm. sad. Again, a little bit exciting. Intense. The atmosphere was very, very intense. You had to be on top of things. And I think that's one of the other reasons why I went into Latin American history and women's studies. Because you really, on this campus at that time, you really had to know your politics. You really had to know where you're from. And so it was very intense. And then a couple of days later, I remember just calling my mom and saying, you know, I think I better come home for a little bit. So I did. And I think I spent a week at home and then came back.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a lot of protesting, more violent protesting, even around Chadburn by that time. And, you know, we were getting inundated with tear gas. Yeah, we had to wear kerchiefs.
Regularly?
Yeah.
Wow.
Kerchief, you know, making sure we had that so we weren't exposed too much to the pepper spray.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because in 1970, the Association of Student Library Workers protested the raising violence on campus, and I wanted to ask if you ever felt unsafe, and how that conversation with your mom went.
I never felt unsafe. For some reason, I never felt unsafe ever, and It was later on in the 70s. I was even mugged, I don't know, on Gorham or Gilman Street, off of State Street. Attempt. There was somebody came from behind me and put a knife at my throat. But even then, I never really felt unsafe. Now that I look back and say that, I don't know why. I mean, I just felt really strong about being out there and figuring out a way to deal with it all.
Yeah.
I was at one of the big protests over on Mifflin Street, where I ended up living on Mifflin Street, and watching a car burn. I remember being in my dorm when, was it Century Food on University Ave, when that burned.
Wow, I didn't even know about that.
Yeah. There was a big fire. One of the grocery stores, main grocery store, burned.
Was there disagreement among students?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yeah. That's why you really had to be on top of stuff. Mm-hmm. And anything you wore was a sign of where you stood. And you had to be, and if you weren't committed, you would be socially kind of ostracized, you know, depending on what group. But there were just so many groups of people.
Yeah. Can you, explain a little more in depth of what those groups looked like?
Very, from SDS, you know, I don't recall Black Panthers, but SDS. They're pretty rough. They were a very intense group. The Marxist socialists, extremely intense.
How so?
And you either agreed with them or you didn't. I mean, you're kind of written off. And most of the TAs were very much socialist. I'm not saying they were in groups, but you know, that was pretty much their bent. And then there were the fraternities. And then there were the intellectuals, like the... So we're just talking about our freshman year because I want to go back to this.
Okay.
Because this happened in my sophomore year. The bombing,
mm-hmm.
the student who was killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you had the intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
Who weren't really a part of very much of anything, I don't think.
Mm.
But I could be wrong about that. Because he was there, you know, innocently there, working,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the middle of the night. There were lakeshore dorms, were mostly athletes. And then there were the students from in and around the area of Madison, the farmers, they weren't going to bother anybody either.
Where did you fall in any of these groups?
I was more active.
Mm-hmm.
I was more active. You know, if there was a demonstration, I definitely wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to partake in any of the really serious violent stuff, but I wanted to observe, which is the reason why I didn't do a whole lot of drinking or drugging, because I liked observing and I wanted to make sure that I was safe.
Mm-hmm.
And and I wanted to stay on campus.
Mm-hmm.
My parents would have, you know, freaked if I had gotten any further involved. And I was afraid that my funding would be cut off.
Mm-hmm.
had to ride that line.
Mm-hmm. Were there any social movements that resonated with you in particular?
No.
More of a blend of movements, or just mostly the observing aspect?
Well, I didn't disagree with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to be more educated about it, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be more educated.
And how were current events discussed in your classes freshman year?
I don't remember a whole lot of classes my freshman year. The only real class I remember was my French class.
Mm.
My other classes, I took a ballet class. No, that was my sophomore. Oh, I think my freshman and sophomore year. I took a ballet class.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my sophomore year classes better than my freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember a whole lot except French. My
mm-hmm.
French class, I had to go to Van Nuys all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my mother, the professor, she knew me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started taking Spanish later on, he came in and said hello.
So what about in your sophomore year at this class, from what you remember in your classes?
Do you want to... Okay, so my sophomore year classes, I remember taking some really, really interesting English classes where Virginia Woolf and Emily Dickinson mm-hmm. were out there. And reading, because I love to read, so that was a natural fit for me. There was a logics class. I wanted to get it so bad, and I just couldn't. I think I bombed on that one. I remember sitting there at Bascom, and, oh, man, I just, you know, a female, I don't know if she was a TA or professor, but I wanted to get it
mm-hmm.
really bad, and I remember going back to the dorm and studying, but I only got so just so far. French, I think I took more French then. And my ballet class for sure. And then spring of that year, as Dan and I got more involved in trying to figure out our relationship, history. You know, I remember going to I can't even remember the name of it, where the history department is. Why?
Well, there's the
Across the street from Chad. Why am I not remembering this?
Oh, humanities. The history department's in humanities now.
Yeah, no, but it maybe wasn't. Not at the time. Well, yeah, at the time it was where the bridge is, across the street from the church. Chadburn.
Oh, Sterling?
Sterling.
Yeah.
Sterling, yeah. I thought it started with a B. But anyways, yeah, and so taking classes there and and sitting around on the floor, I see that now in Bascom.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I remember that. But very, very few of us were going to classes at that point. It was kind of on the downside. So you want to get to sophomore year? Or?
Sure. Okay. Wherever you'd like to.
Okay, so this is the really important thing.
Okay.
So I worked at a factory during the summer because my dad knew a guy from his job who had a small factory. And so, of course, my ex-boyfriend was there with his friends, and I was there, and, you know, some girls from school were there. That, you know, some of them were friends of mine. And so I made small timers. And the boys got more money because they were able to carry boxes for us. They did the same kind of work, but because they were able to carry our very heavy boxes of machinery, they got more money. And longer smoke breaks. So then my mother wanted me to take a class or take a course at Parkside. And of course I was in that class with my ex-boyfriend. And then Dan, I saw him bicycle in. He's from Kenosha. He bicycled into Parkside our first night, and he wanted to look at the timetable because he didn't know where he was going either. I was getting ready for my sophomore year, being really excited, and is there something I can drink?
There is a water fountain. Would you like to drink
it? I know there's a water
fountain. Yeah. Okay.
So, sophomore year. So we getting ready. It was very excited during the summer to go back, and I was more sure of myself, and being in Chadburn, and I think I had my own room, because we could do that at the time, and because I was going to, you know, returning, to the dorm, where a lot of people were not wanting to stay in the dorm anymore. They found houses on campus, and people wanted to stay in houses because there was just much more freedom. Mm-hmm. I needed the structure, and it didn't really, you know, I didn't find it attractive to go to a house. And I liked being really close on campus mm-hmm. because it gets really cold mm-hmm. during the winter. And so, I liked that life. And the dorm that year, they were going to have a little sister's weekend. Well, I didn't have little sisters. I had little brothers, but not little sisters. So my cousin, one of my cousins, she was at the appropriate age, and my uncle, her father, was on campus here. He graduated from Horlick High School in Racine as an All-State guard. And so he was on the Badger football team his freshman year and lived at Camp Randall. So, and I think my aunt, I forget where she went to school, La Crosse maybe. And so it was really a good fit for Susan to have Little Sisters Weekend. So getting ready for all of that and being on campus and, you know, And then all of a sudden, the bombing occurred. Mm. And that happened right behind Chadburn. A little too close for comfort, so we called off Little Sisters Weekend.
Oh.
And, yeah, because that was going to happen right away in September, I believe. That was really hard. Mm-hmm. That was really hard on all of us. So that orientation week, we had the beer party, and Dan came off the, you know, off the elevator, and so we had been dating, I think, pretty strongly for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that, mm-hmm. and then he said, "My uncle's coming in. Do you want to meet him?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, fine. Why is he coming?" Because he is, I forget what his position was with the ATF. And so he was coming to investigate. And, of course, he didn't have the time to meet with us. So that was kind of interesting. And at that point, I think a lot of people were trying to disassociate themselves from that kind of activity, because that really, I mean, to have that happen on campus went a little bit too far, you know, especially after Kent State. Mm-hmm. That was the start of sophomore year.
Did you feel like you needed to disassociate yourself from?
I did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was not a part of anything. Mm. He was one of those that just wanted to stay clear of any kind of campus, you know, or any activists or protests or demonstrations. That wasn't for him.
Okay. Did you participate in any anti-war rallies?
Oh yeah, all the time, because they were all over. Mm. So you could just join up with any one of them. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do you have any recollections of like interactions with police during protesting?
No, I stay far enough away from that.
What about students in general, their relationship with police?
Well, okay, so Judy, this was our discussion this morning, because I remember seeing her now husband. Mm-hmm. He was more of a violent protester. Mm-hmm. And he would be hiding behind the bushes around Chadburn Hall, running from the police or National Guard or whatever. And so Judy came on campus. She was my actual first friend. I've known her since we were 13 years old. Who joined me? None of my girlfriends from high school and grade school were allowed to come to Madison. Mm-hmm. I don't even think to visit, because that's how bad.
Wow.
That had a pretty bad reputation, mm-hmm. especially from small town Racine. And so their parents weren't allowed and didn't allow them to do that. And so Judy, I don't know why her parents allowed her to do it, but in any case. She did, but she didn't arrive until January, and Dan and I were already pretty too involved, and so we didn't see each other a whole lot. But then she started dating Jay, and Jay was pretty rough. I mean, he was pretty into it, really into it. Mm-hmm. When it really started to even die down, he was still pretty into it. And she said he was arrested twice. Mm-hmm. So it was around me, but Dan and I were just, you know, trying to find our relationship and where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
It was the era of the love story, mm-hmm. and he was going to go to law school. So yeah.
So in May of 1970, there was a students protested the Kent State bombings, and the National Guard was called to campus. Do you remember this at all?
Mm-hmm.
Can you share your recollection of it?
Oh yeah, it was a pretty heavy time, and I think a lot of us stay to ourselves because it was scary. And then it wasn't just the Kent State bombing, because at the same time we found out about the My Lai massacre. Hmm. So we were very anti-police, very anti National Guard on campus. And we didn't know if stepping out of the dorm would, you know, be a bad thing or a good thing. You know, we just didn't know. And that was the hard part, because the campus is so big, it could come from anywhere. And so, and you didn't know if it was going to be students, because they were turning over cars and lighting police cars on fire and grocery stores and whatever. So it was coming from all over. And so it was pretty intense, yes. Mm. That was very, very difficult time. And again, you really had to be on top of stuff, because I'm thinking, My Lai, what, you know, what is this language? Mm-hmm. You know, what is this? And even though we did cover, I remember my social studies class in high school, war, not so much exactly the Vietnam War. I mean, we saw it on television. We just took it for granted. Oh, yeah, it's the war again on television. And so wasn't until Kent State and My Lai Massacre that we really, really had to, you know, buckle down and figure out what was going on. And it was difficult to know who to trust. Mm. And so I think a lot of people kind of stayed to themselves at that point if they weren't actively involved, like Judy's husband Jay. Judy and, you know, and I didn't have my group of friends. Mm-hmm. At that time, from high school or from anywhere, there was no one I could share that with, absolutely no one. So I felt pretty isolated.
So how did you navigate trusting people or trusting sources? From?
I just didn't. I mean, you know, I went to my classes and, you know, try to do my work and, you know, take in the atmosphere, and mm-hmm. that's about it.
What about the university's reaction and university policies?
Do you know the history of Charlie Brown? Peanuts character?
I know the cartoons. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. You never see adults, right?
Yes.
We never saw adults. After we went autonomous from the university, I mean, that's how the Pail and Shovel came into play. I still miss him. the students took over. There was, you know, I don't remember a reaction from the university, now that you say that. Mm-hmm. I just don't remember that.
Do you think this influenced, like, your maturity or your independence? And
God, yes. Mm-hmm. In comparison to how you all are coming to campus and your mothers and fathers are hovering over you, and, you know, they're online, you know, checking everything out for you. I mean, there was none of that. Mm-hmm. None of that. As I had, you know, discussed with our initial meeting with Alex and Troy, I wouldn't go to a school that would give my parents that kind of information. You know, mm-hmm. I'm here now.
Yeah.
This is me. You know, I'm mm-hmm. going to be doing this. And thank God my parents went along with that. You know, I mean, my mother, who'd been on campus, of course she wanted to be a part of it, but she didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think my dad would have. Anyways. But when she was on campus, I mean, she couldn't even call home. They didn't have telephones. It was writing letters.
So what was your parents' reaction to the social action on campus?
Nothing.
Nothing?
No, none. No. Right. I mean, it was good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm happy about it, that they didn't try mm-hmm. to influence me one way or the other. I guess that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. You know, the hovering in your generation of parents, that's how I would call it, I guess that would be an appropriate term. Is not, I don't understand it. I really, really don't. And I have a niece. I'm very, very close to my niece. Mm-hmm. But I don't understand that. you know, you've got to figure out things for yourself.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely. So what about during your sophomore year, the talk of this in your classes, at least? I know you mentioned
very socialist. I mean, mm-hmm. there it was very intense that way.
Mm-hmm. How'd you feel about that?
I was okay with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a new way of thinking for me because my Mexican background was all about selling stuff to stay alive. You know, my grandfather did, he had three jobs, worked for a factory, sold fruit and vegetables in a, you know, a stand, and then picked up junk from the Jewish stores and took it to the dump for them, and did farmer's market. He'd go to the farms, my grandparents, it was not just him. They'd go to the farmer's market and pick up produce and sell at farmer's markets. So that, you know, that's my, and then going to Mexico and then people selling things there. My parents, however, were completely different. Mm-hmm. My dad loved the factory, J.I.K.'s factory. He was a company man, as the Japanese would say. And my mother was a teacher. She had no entrepreneurial spirit whatsoever. Neither one of them.
I see. Okay, so this is...
What was that leading to? What was the question?
That's okay. This is about discussions in your classes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, mm-hmm. to learn about socialism, which the Latin Americans were doing anyways, all over, they were starting that discussion. So for me, it was great. And I'm like, okay, let's learn about this. However, being with Dan, he was very, very much Republican. I was very much the opposite.
What was
that
like?
Different. Very different. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, we didn't talk about it that much.
So, in October, this is reverting back to freshman year, if you don't mind. But
oh, freshman year?
Yes.
Okay.
So, this is October of 1969. There was, like, demonstrations in the Capitol against cuts in the state welfare budget. Do you remember this?
No, that I don't.
Okay. I was going to ask about state and local government.
No.
Okay.
This was all over. My experience on campus really was over the war.
Mm. So how did, from your freshman year to your sophomore year, were there any changes in the way that the war was covered at all?
Oh.
In your classes, I mean.
No.
No. Okay.
No, because in 68, I mean, it was pretty well established, mm-hmm. you know, that, I mean, who was going to stay, who wasn't going to mm-hmm. stay. What kind of was interesting to me at the time, and now even more interesting to me, you know, the outside agitators, who were they? You know, where was the SDS? You know, I heard talk about them. Did I actually ever meet anybody? Because everybody was underground. You know, anybody who had any serious intention of doing anything radical, they were underground. So we heard all of this, Black Panthers, whatever, and that they were going to be on campus, and I was very curious, but I never saw it.
Mm-hmm. So, is there anything else you want to add about your sophomore year, or anything that any particular memories that stick out?
No. Not right now. Not that I can think of. Mm-hmm.
So then, can you talk more about leaving UW after in 1971, you said?
Yeah. Well, and that's where things kind of break up. You see the breakup of the anti-war activities. And so I wasn't on campus. I lived with my parents, and my mother was very, very upset with me. And Dan and I decided that we were going to get married and go back to school, which drove her crazy. And we did. So we sat out the year and we got married and then went back. We both tried to go back, but I couldn't. I couldn't stay in school. And I didn't want to. I didn't have any ambition at that time. I wanted to be a housewife. And so I joined then after our marriage, and he was continuing school, what would have been our junior year. I joined the Dames, UW Dames, wives of students at the university.
What is that called? UW?
Dames.
Dames.
That was one of the best things that happened to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I learned a lot because my mother was a teacher. She was not brought up to be a housewife. And so I learned nothing from her. I, you know, learned more from my grandmother in that direction, cooking, because my mother didn't even cook. And so neither did my aunt. And I wanted to take after my grandmother, who was the hippie. She did everything. She did everything. Sewed, crocheted, just like all Mexican women. Didn't shave, didn't wear a bra, So she was who I wanted to be. And so the Dames provided me with a lot of education. We educated each other. We were in book clubs, so read a lot of really good books. Mm-hmm. And they still stand up today, like Jane Goodall, mm-hmm. The Shadow of Man. And got in touch with, women, strong women. And learned how to cook some really, really good dishes that I still love today. Tatting. I didn't know how to crochet, but I did know how to knit. So I learned how to tat and do a little bit of quilting. And so every month there was something going on that we were learning. And it was really neat. I loved it. I love that time.
How many women were in the group with you?
Maybe 10.
Are you in touch with any today still?
No. So
you did that when you returned to UW?
Yeah. When we sat out, then we got married in August. He started school, and then I started school and dropped out because I worked. Mm-hmm. I worked at Madison General Hospital. Oh. And I was taking secretarial courses at the business school on Washington Avenue right behind our apartment, because we lived on Mifflin Street, 321 Mifflin Street, West Mifflin Street, from 1972.
So
I worked in medical records at Madison General Hospital. So I loved it. Loved the women with whom I was working, and the work itself, and I was reading medical stuff. I was able to read the files, and so it was very, very cool learning about all the different things that people do to themselves, make them come into the emergency room. But this is the really interesting part here of working there. I learned that Carlton Armstrong had been working there, and he was one of the bombers, and everybody loved him. He
You'd walk women out to the cars in the parking lot, their cars in the parking lot, because it was just a dangerous time, really, to be on campus for women. And guys, my brothers told me that they were attacked too. Wasn't just women. And so it was a very dangerous time, so Carleton was really good about making sure that they were all safe. I think it was a janitor at Madison General Hospital. So it was very interesting to hear that bit, after my experience with the bombing. And then one, I don't know if it was a holiday or just a Sunday morning, I had to go in to take medical records in, up to the floors. And when I got back from one of my rounds, I saw a note on my typewriter that was placed there. And it said, talked about it was a bomb threat note. And that kind of scared me off. It really did. I had a hard time going back to that job. And so then I started working for another clinic over by on Washington Avenue, mm-hmm. West Wash, by my apartment. And then from there, I went to the Department of Psychiatry. And then Dan and I divorced while I was working there. And then I went back to school.
And was that in 1976? What was your return like when you got back to school?
Awful. It was an awful feeling because I was old in comparison to all of the other students. But it was good in the sense that I had a perspective, and I learned that I had and have a little bit of a learning disability, and so I got myself tutors, and that worked out really, really well. I knew I could write, so then everything went really well after that, really well. Mm-hmm. Then I left Department of Psychiatry to be full-time.
You left to be a full-time student. I see. And you were doing the same majors, studying the same subjects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one. Yeah, exactly. Well, and you have to. When you're, mm-hmm. Go into your junior year, you get hauled in by one of the departments and you've got to declare.
Mm-hmm. Were there any differences in campus climate by the time you got back? Can you talk about those a little?
Oh, yeah. Very complacent. About, politics, I would say. I guess I could call mm-hmm. it that. Because pretty much everything was over by that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was the disco era. And so it was fun. And I mainly studied and got myself acquainted with South Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Hung out with a lot of South Americans. Lived at the Union.
Which Union?
Memorial.
Oh.
South had just been built.
I didn't know you could live there.
No, I mean, I stayed there from morning, noon, and night. And then walked back home to Mifflin Street.
You still lived on Mifflin Street. Yeah. I was picturing the hotels. I was picturing the dorms converting to hotels.
No. That's what I would call living there. Had all my meals there. Well, except for Ella's Deli.
Where was that?
It makes me want to cry that you even ask that question. It's where there. It's a the UW something. I don't know. It's a hamburger place now.
Oh.
Right on State Street there. There was a lot of coffee drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what? Okay, so this is freshman year. Another thing that kind of stands out was that my friends and I would go to Ella's Deli, Jewish, obviously. And so my parents would only give me so much money. And I could not afford to pay for cream cheese. So I could only have my bagels with butter and jelly and coffee. And I hated coffee, but I made myself drink it just to be part of the group.
And then when I went back to school, there were still a lot of coffee shops and Rennebaum's, and my mother loved Rennebaum's and their cinnamon whatever rolls or pastry that they had, and so I'd eat at those places, not so much in the dorm, and then just the Union. Yeah, I pretty much, like I said, you know, I was a library hound too. I stayed in. Memorial Library.
That's my favorite too.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of elegance there.
Yeah. So you talked about complacency. Would you categorize that, or would you attribute that to the student body or to the just change in time?
Just the change in time.
I see.
It's the disco era.
But in 1978, the students did protest a Supreme Court ruling, and with the Regents University, the Regents of the University of California versus Black. Yeah, do you recall this at all?
No,
because there was because that was sort of like the main protest that I could find from 1978.
Yeah, no.
But you don't recall many protests?
No, not at that time period. Mm-hmm. Well, there were things going on, definitely. Mm-hmm. And to be caught up in all, for me to be caught up in all of that would have been an extreme hardship. Mm-hmm. I was really dedicated to studying and having a good time, but I really wanted to get my studies done. Mm-hmm. You know, I really loved what I was doing a lot.
Did any classes from your time in 76, 78 stick out to you?
All of them do. They were just fabulous. Mm-hmm. I mean, there wasn't anything that I didn't like. Immigration, the women's studies. I mean, it was all fabulous to me.
Any professors that stick out?
Yeah, my immigration history professor, and I don't know his name. I'm really sad to say that. I love that guy. He was excellent. So was my TA. Mm-hmm. And then women's studies, the same. There was one... I think it was women in literature, and loved that class. And we kept a journal, which was coming in. It was just coming into the kind of studying way to study things, learn things. So I was really grateful for that because I was always kept not always, but I kept diaries from here and there. I mean, from time to time, Yeah, that really sticks out, just being at the Women History Program building. It was a house, and I just loved it. But the best professor was, I wish I had his name, was my tennis professor.
Oh.
And again, he had us keep a journal. And that's when I decided to go from Christine to Christina, because in first grade, the nun changed my name from Christina to Christine with an H. And so at that point, I wanted to be special. So that's the only thing I can describe. But anyways, so I really wanted him to call me Christina. And go back to that, and to this day I still remember the techniques he taught us, because we had to do a journal, you know, and I had to take the bus or ride my bike out to the tennis courts out there from Mifflin Street. So early in the morning was first of the morning class.
So what did you do after graduation, in between law school?
And that's when my brother died. So I worked at undergraduate admissions office.
Okay.
Well, first I worked for the university in their medical records department. Then I got a job on Murray Street or Peterson, whatever that was. I think it was Peterson. And because it was the Peterson building on Murray Street. I think it was the Peterson building on Murray Street where my mother lived. And my mother lived on Murray Street, and I lived in Murray House. And when my niece went to school, she lived in Hazelton House, and her grandmother's name was Hazel. And now her child one of her children, Sienna Hazel. Oh. And she does not want to be called Hazel, and we're like, okay. I worked there for 2 years and then went to law school.
How was your experience working there?
I loved it. I loved it, but again, it really exposed me to a lot of non-student, just what I would call regular people, you know, from around the Madison area who would drive in and work there. Mm-hmm. And very prejudiced, very conservative people, by and large, not all of them. I got to know a Native American woman who was seriously, totally the opposite of some of the others, you know, where she was very private. She would play Native American music in her office space. And, you know, it bothered some other people because it was just, you know, too much for them. Got to be friends with the woman who did all of the foreign applications. Mm-hmm. So got to know all of, you know, the writings and whatever for the foreign students. Mm-hmm. Loved that. That was very interesting. And then one day, Carlton Armstrong came back and enrolled.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he was accepted back?
Yeah, I think so.
Did you process any of his application?
We all went out to the office when he came in.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very... Then he started up a juice truck, a food truck Library Mall. I don't know if it's still there. Might be.
What was the reaction when you all went to see him out there?
We wanted to see if he looked like the devil, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how evil looking was this guy that he could do this? And he wasn't. You know, he's just a really ordinary, handsome looking guy.
That's really interesting that you had so many run-ins with
Carlton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then when you returned to law, when you came for law school, it was 1981?
Mm-hmm.
And how was that experience?
Scary. Very scary. I was excited again to know that I could be a lawyer. Yay!
Mm-hmm.
And have some direction. On the other hand, it was very intimidating. I didn't know what to expect. And... So I didn't work. I poured myself into my studies and had a really good time with my friend Bev Jamboys. We hung out. We would eat our lunch at Chadburn and go back to the law school and take over the lounge so we could watch our soap operas.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so my second year of law school, I was... student bar rep, so I could take over the lounge and watch our soap operas, and nobody would have a chance to take, you know, use the television when we wanted it. And then my last year, I was student bar president.
Oh, how was that?
Fun, but it got ugly because a lot of the people, you know, who thought you were going to be doing something for them. You know, and it turned out, well, no, I'm going to be doing something for these people over here. And then they'd get mad and blah, blah, blah. You had to deal with all of that. And that was the last time I wanted to do that.
What were the responsibilities of that role?
Making sure certain activities were taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
Basically that.
Mm-hmm.
Organizing parties,
which
I love.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it wasn't just that, but it was, you know, speaking, public speaking. And...
Was there a particular legal field that you were interested in during law school, or did that change?
It changed, but what I loved was antitrust law and contract law. Those, but what I did well in was criminal law and the Terry Stop situation. Or no, it was a Terry Stop probable cause situation, but it was I won't be able to remember it now. It was... stereotyping. How do I want to say this? There's a formal legal term for stereotyping drug dealers coming into the country, coming into the airport. Mm-hmm. And I did extremely well on my exam for that. And I love that. Because I was older going back to law school, or going to law school, going back to undergraduate, going to law school, I was older, and I knew a lot of drug dealers.
So, did you feel a different sort of atmosphere on campus when you came back at law school, or did you have a different perspective because you were older than the majority of the students?
Well, I think the fact that I was a minority stuck out more than anything else, because I was in the minority program, the Leo program, and that's what really sticks out, mm-hmm. is that.
Can you talk more about that experience?
Wasn't pleasant, because everybody thinks you get in just because you're a minority. So the pressure's on. And it was very unpleasant. Very unpleasant. And, a lot of people, you knew that was the underlying direction, but it was a very conservative atmosphere. Very conservative. The professors weren't, but the campus was. Law school campus.
What was that like being in this conservative atmosphere on this larger liberal campus?
Bad. I didn't like it. So I just got closer with, the minority people, some of the Jewish women in the group. There was in a group with some Jewish women, and because I was very, we were one of the first classes where the number of women was higher than mm-hmm. in the past.
Was there any direct, were any of the students that you interacted with directly rude to you and directly
insulting? Yes.
Yeah.
Insulting? Yes. Including other Hispanics who were there not in the Leo program. There was one in particular from Colorado who wore his, I don't think it was that, it was the equivalent of a Ralph Lauren logo on his shirts. And he came from a wealthier family from Colorado. He had to be, he was out of state. And yeah, he made it very clear. He only got here on, a scholarship, minority scholarship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was a subject for a lot of people. Very unpleasant.
Mm. So while you were in law school, was there student activism and protests on campus? No. Or did you see that among undergraduate students?
No.
Mm. So what would you like attribute to the conservatism in law school? Was it just like the wealthier students, or?
Yeah, it's a very elitist profession. Very elitist profession.
Did an education in law change how you viewed social protests?
No.
No?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that's you'd like to add about your law school experience on campus?
had a lot of fun. Well, I wasn't just a student barber either. I still hung in there with the women's program. So what happened in law school was that at that point there were very few programs that specifically were directed at groups of people. There was a Leo program and for the minorities. Then there was the women's law student group. And to be honest with you, I don't think there was any other student group other than the women. Later, there was the Native American, whatever that is now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of my closest friends, too, was Native American. She's now a judge for Ho-Chunk, Winnebago. And Bev is no longer an attorney. She got out of it before, not too much after we got out of law school, which was a case where a lot of my corporate lawyer friends, they hated it.
Hmm.
And I was loving it. I was loving being a lawyer. I still do. And so now, there's a breakdown for pretty much a lot of students, you know, in their individual, need or interest area in law school. So I was one of the officers of the Women's Law Student Association also.
What did you do for that?
I was a secretary, so I took notes. But basically, we just gave support to women. You know, we just wanted to make sure that women knew, you know, we belonged there,
mm-hmm.
basically.
What was your experience in your classes being a woman? Or was there a collective experience of people?
No. You know, now that you mention that, no.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the professors, I mean, unless you were really at the top of your class and they were picking you out to do certain work, I didn't experience anything, you know, any discrimination,
mm-hmm.
nothing from the professors. And I had a lot of really good professors. That was a good experience with the professors.
And among your peers?
I mm-hmm. came out of there with a lot of, I was there with a lot of friends. Bev was really the only one who stuck. The mm-hmm. other corporate lawyers, we kind of broke up after our second or third year away from law school because
mm-hmm.
we were in different parts of the world, the country, whatever. And different ages also. They were a lot younger than I am. They were just starting their families. So, and I was loving being an attorney, and they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really understand that too much.
So I found the 1984 awards convocation honoring like student service and scholarship, that you were a recipient of a scholarship for contributing to the life of the student body.
That's because I was student bar president.
That was student
bar
president?
You give that
to every
student bar president.
Okay, I see.
It was the Ruth Doyle?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, he's the governor's mother.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. So were those the two main organizations you were involved in
mm-hmm.
during law school?
Mm-hmm. I don't think there was a Hispanic Lawyers,
mm-hmm.
a Student Law Association. I don't think so. I could be very wrong about that, but I don't recall one.
Mm.
But those were the two.
So is there anything else that you want to add about your UW experience or something that you don't think we covered?
What I don't like that happened was the divide between my friends and I who didn't go to college. And the ones who did, and the ones who stayed home. Or closer to home, got their degree from, like, Parkside.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in Messina, Kenosha. And I'm seeing that on an economic level as well, on a financial level, you know, mm-hmm. of where we are. Because in the 70s and 60s, we rebelled not just about the war.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cultural revolution as well. And, you know, we judged everybody by whether you were part of the establishment or not. And that meant judging, I guess is that would be the term these days, judging in a very negative way women who did not go to college and had families versus the ones who did go to college,
mm-hmm.
had a lot of relationships with men, and don't have such a sound financial portfolio, because that wasn't valued by those of us who we were so anti-establishment that having money was not a concern for us. But it's going to hurt. I mean, it hurts us now. And I'm really surprised at the difference that it, you know, how all of that's caught up. To us where we sit right now, being retired or not retired,
mm-hmm.
for some of us. And even my cousin Teresa, when she was here, I mean, she followed me the year after, 2 years after, here at Madison. And she got married and had a baby right away.
Mm-hmm.
And how she handled that and how she feels about herself. And I think, you know, for self-esteem, when I'm doing divorce work for women my age group and up, that's what I see is total lack of confidence and self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
They might have money. Their husbands might have earned the money and they have a pension. But I call them the unfinished women because they don't have anything of their own except through their husband. They have children, and most of my friends, their kids are doing fabulous, absolutely fabulous. And but they kind of still want to be moms, but that doesn't give them the confidence and self-esteem that a lot of my friends who have gone away to school and have had careers and it causes a lot of friction and tension. And then also politically, especially
mm-hmm.
now. You know, I feel like we're back in the Nixon era. You know, you make a choice. You're either for Nixon or you're not. There are no two ways about it. And that's the way I feel now. So after this, I'm going to be with my friend Judy. And because that's where I feel comfortable right now. You know, just thinking about how all this happened and why, you know, I have a reunion coming up
in 2 weeks with childhood friends, and friends with Judy too. And I don't want to be with half of them right now because they supported Trump. And I don't, you know, it's not rational. It's not rational. Not that, you know, I don't like either party. I really don't like either party. But, you know, the View, especially Walker and the Republicans, what they did the other night, I'm having a really hard time handling this. Really hard time. Because I thought I thought that what was going on with the Trump administration was so clearly wrong and mean and evil that, you know, Walker, I mean, here, you know, that this happened the other night, this vote happened the way it did. I mean, is our democracy really threatened? On the other hand, that's what caused Republicans to go in that direction, extreme direction, because the anti-establishment group were so, you know, thinking more on the socialist, Bernie Sanders kind of view, position. And so I feel like I'm back there in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And it's not pleasant. I don't want to be in that position. And then I caught up with somebody from high school I didn't know, or I vaguely knew, and over Facebook. And I want to know more about what he did at Eau Claire, because he's a genius, and he should have been a surgeon, and he's not. And when I ask him, you know, like, what were the protest days like, mm-hmm. you know, up in Madison? Protest? Why would we protest? There were girls and drugs and alcohol. Why would I protest anything? And I'm like, I don't know that I can have that in my life. You know what I mean? I mean, at least with Dan, so let me give you the history of Dan. We divorced in 76, and then we got back together in 2002. And so we broke up last year. So for 14 years, I was with him because we're so bonded. I'm so bonded. We're very bonded, and we're still, you know, dealing with each other, and he works for me. I'm not going to cut him out of my life. You know, like with Judy, we are bonded. Having been here, going to school, and going through those times, and even though Dan thinks entirely different politically than I do, there's no way I'm going to cut him out of my life. It's too much of my life from back then. And so when this friend of mine, you know, when he said that, I'm like, you know, I can be friends with you. It's really kind of a stupid thing. But it was just a weird, you know, I don't know how anybody can ignore that. So, you know, having been here did make an impact. I don't know if it's the impact my mother actually wanted for me, you know, or thought I would ever have, because she couldn't have been less. She was so passive about all this. And my father, too, he was oblivious. And, I mean, he is and he isn't. He is interested in politics. My mother just never really wanted to talk about it. So yeah, it just keeps coming back. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little teary-eyed.
No.
Plus, my father's in hospice right now. At home. And so thinking about all of that.
I'm sure.
You know, and I'm sure it was pretty scary for him to let me come to school here.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. This is a fun thing, but not from college, but my parents started bringing us up here as a way to make sure I went to school here, but I really didn't have a choice. But my very, 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 very first, my very first recollection of coming to Madison was going into Memorial Union and seeing beatniks.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very cool. And then they took us to Bascom. We have pictures of that. But, yeah, see the beatniks barefoot. So I was always barefoot. My mother was always upset with me because I was always barefoot. Well, hippies were barefoot, you know, or sandals, very skippy sandals. So it's me, my mother, her sister, and her brothers. And then me, Teresa, my brothers were here. But they didn't graduate from here. Mm-hmm. Michael died too. Michael died when he was at Parkside because he went home to Parkside and after 2 years. The other thing, mini courses. I learned how to play pool. And I didn't realize that my family has an inkling, predisposition for playing pool. And I didn't know that until, you know, people are coming out with their pool cues, and, you know, their own that they purchased. A lot of my cousins play. And so I love those mini classes. That was really fun. My mother always gave me money to make sure I was in some sort of physical class. Aerobics in law school had just started. Mm. So she made sure I had money enough to be able to do that. Mm. And what are they going to say? As part of my education, because that's what she liked. But I think it was pretty hard on my dad because I really went in a direction that he really didn't want his daughter to go in.
Which direction?
Not being a housewife, a mother. Mm-hmm. And being so independent, mm-hmm. you know, living on my own, even though he pretty much was a big help with all of that. And so he didn't want me to be totally like my mom either, you know. He didn't want me to be either a housewife or like mm-hmm. my mom. So I really don't know. Maybe before my dad dies, I'll ask him. But those are pretty intense conversations to have with him. And that's where we're at. So, and Dan, when I told him, yeah, we'll be talking about you. And he said, yeah, you are going to be talking about me, right? And I'm like, yes, you'll be talked about. Yeah, no problem. Yeah, especially with his uncle being here to investigate.
Yeah.
And he did work for them, and he was high up there in the food chain for the ATF. That's where he was. That's where he stayed. And then even when after he retired, he did consultations. Mm. He was a contract worker for the ATF. Yeah, that was pretty weird. I mean, that was very, very weird. Oh, and one of the other reasons why I felt safe in the downtown living mm-hmm. on Mifflin Street downtown, because the now apartment and parking lot across the street from where I lived on Mifflin Street was next to the AT&T building. And that was put up when Dan and I first moved in there. And then there was a parking lot. There was the Badger bus station in one corner, and the rest of it was parking lot. But after bar time, well, a couple of the bars closer mm-hmm. to the Capitol were gay. And so that's where a lot of the gay men parked. And so going through that parking lot at 2 o'clock in the morning, not a problem. What was really interesting was to find there were a lot of police there also.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a very interesting community right mm-hmm. there. So I always felt safe coming through there. There were a couple of blocks that weren't, but you know, when some guy comes up on you with a knife at 7 o'clock on a busy street, there was traffic mm-hmm. coming on, it must have been Coral. Oh. You know, it was like a half a block away from State Street. Yeah, you know, you're either safe or you're not. Mm-hmm. But there were, oh, well, this is interesting. I did do volunteer work for Women's Transit Authority mm-hmm. because of this. And I did some volunteer work for a runaway center called Briar Patch. And there was one young woman who disappeared. She was hitchhiking, and she disappeared. And, you know, I got stories from a lot of women who tried doing that, and they were raped. I mean, it was really pretty nasty. And so I did the Women's Transit Authority for that reason, drive around after midnight, pick up women, or after 10, and take them wherever. And like I said, my brothers, too, reported to me that they would be attacked in the bathrooms on campus.
Wow.
Pretty wild time.
Yeah.
Community pharmacy was on State Street in the basement under, I don't know what's there now. It is a urban. The urban.
Oh.
Yeah, like in that area.
Oh, yeah.
That was a community pharmacy downstairs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so.
Oh, no.
Yeah. 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 So those were, yeah. That is still there. So I'm happy that's still there. One room of one's own came in that mm-hmm. time, in the late 70s. Oh, yeah, I had a lot of fabulous meals there. Because they had a restaurant. And then it burned. One New Year's Eve, that burned. That was bad.
Yeah.
Really bad. Yeah, I can't think of anything else that comes to mind.
If there is, we can do a follow-up over the phone if there's something that comes to mind.
Yeah, I'd like that.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. What time is it? Okay. Coming here today, we went past the Babcock area,
mm-hmm.
And I remember coming out here when it was below zero and really getting, I mean, I had two pairs of pants on and I don't know what kind of boots, but I was freezing. And we had to come out here, pick up our enrollment papers and then go to the different departments and get the departments to sign off on the courses that we wanted to take in the freezing cold in January to enroll. Crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, in comparison to when my niece, when she started in 2000, and they by that time they were they started to do things on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, what? You have it so easy? That's just wrong. You should be forced to march around the whole campus to get your classes just like we did. You appreciate them more. Yeah, so that's what I thought of when coming out here. And I think we had to pick up stuff over at the armory too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there was a swimming pool in there and, you know, people would, I'm like, really? You can go there? Who gets to go there? Well, right now it's just guys. You know, I'm like, oh, okay. That's why I haven't heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they had a swimming pool in there and it was pretty much a private club of who could go there. I mean, anybody probably could go there, but, you know, it didn't look like it at the time. But I do want to say this about Pail and Shovel, okay? Mm-hmm. They made it a lot of fun. They put some flamingos and the Lady of Liberty in Mendota. It was fun. It was a fun time. When I wasn't in school, they made it fun. So that was it. So on Sunday nights, the dorm's food hall was not open. The cafeteria was not open. We had our big meal at around 1 or 12 o'clock, and then we would have to go to a restaurant, which there weren't that many at the time, my freshman year. And so Portobello's and Pisan's were all one. Portobello's being off of State Street, I think it's on Lake. And then downstairs was Pisan's. And it was, how do you want to say, the Italian grotto kind of atmosphere down there. So that was the in place to go. I mean, that was just the place to go if you wanted to do something cool. Or you would pick up your sandwich, because we didn't order pizza because they were expensive. The sandwiches, the Garibaldi submarine kind of like sandwiches, were I think 99 cents at the time. And so that was all I could afford. So that's what we would get on Sundays
for dinner was at Garibaldi, and not even any soda, because really soda wasn't all that popular in those days. And so that's what we ate. And now you can get them over there. It was on Doty Street. I forget what the name of the street is where Pisons is right now. You can, you know, have a view of the lake if you want. And they did a really nice job. They went from lake then over to closer to the dorms on University, between University and Johnson, where Whole Foods is right now. Mm-hmm. That, you know, Pisons wasn't there.
Oh.
So they took Pisons out and then put it over there on the other side of the square. So, yeah, that's a, you know, a lot of people from my age group would remember that, and I could see them all going to the new Pisons, relatively new Pisons. But in law school, too, we'd go to the one over here. I mean, when it was over there on University and Johnson, we'd go over there and, you know, have our big group meetings and, like I said, have a lot of good fun and drinking.
Okay. Okay, so today's July 15th, 2019, and my name is Faith Hoffmeyer. We're currently in the Steenbach Library. And can you please spell your first and last name for me?
Sure. My name is Cristina, C-R-I-S-T-I-N-A. Last name is Mondragon, M-O-N-D-R-A-G-O-N.
Great. Just making sure the volume's good. Okay. So this is a follow-up interview from our last interview in December, and you requested to discuss women's sexual activity in the 1960s, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you want to start off with?
Not necessarily. I'm curious to see what you have.
Sure. Wonderful. Sorry, I'm just trying to adjust the sound here. It's a little loud. Okay.
Yeah, that's good. Up. Right.
Perfect. Okay. So how would you describe attitudes on campus towards women's sexual activity in the 1960s?
Excited, I think. Excited, curious. It really was a priority. That's about the best I could describe it, as a priority in finding a mate and experiencing what we could.
Did it feel like a revolution to you at the time?
Yes. Yeah, it was an extreme change.
Mm-hmm.
One of my friends described it perfectly. We were so unprepared. I mean, we didn't see it coming. My cousin, my girlfriend, and I, we are from Racine, very Catholic school girls,
mm-hmm.
Very Catholic. One of them did go to a Catholic high school. My cousin and I did not. But very Catholic. Our families were very Catholic, very prudish. In a kind way, I'm trying to say that in a kind way because, you know, I'm reflecting back. And the last thing on our, you know, that could happen was to go home pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
But we are all very curious, very eager, and we had to take a different mindset.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very big split, and I think that was part of the whole experience of being anti-establishment,
mm-hmm.
anti-war mentality, is there had to be a break there too.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church couldn't condone us for having sex outside of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we did not accept that as being a truth,
mm-hmm.
And or God, I should say, rather than the church. The church certainly could. Our parents certainly could.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to go home and not be cut off from our families for experiencing sex or getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, because getting pregnant obviously would tell everybody, yes, we were having sex,
mm-hmm.
outside of marriage.
So obviously this was hidden from your parents and your family.
Oh, yeah, big okay. time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so how did attending Catholic school affect your mindset during your time in college? Were you ever conflicted with your experiences?
No, because we were oblivious. Mm-hmm. You know, we had absolutely no idea what to expect coming to Madison. Mm-hmm. None. I mean, we were caught unprepared. Mm-hmm. You know, we were really taken aback, none of our friends were experiencing sex that they were telling us. You know, I think there were groups, especially in my high school, at the Catholic high school, that was very small. People mm-hmm. would know. But in my high school, we were over 600. Mm-hmm. And, you know, probably there were people who were having sex, but not in my little world. Mm-hmm. Not with my friends.
So are you talking about your high school friends or your college friends?
High school.
Okay. And then, but college was different. What were your friends experiencing in college? Were they vocal about their experiences?
Well, I would say freshman year, not so much. I mean, we were getting oriented to, number one, leaving home. Mm-hmm. Number two, making friends in our dorm, because they were not co-ed. Mm-hmm. And then... feeling safe going out because it was anti-war time. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of protests, a lot of demonstrations, some very violent, and trying not to get caught up with that. Or if that's what you wanted to do, you know, there were, you, it was all open, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not you wanted to demonstrate and protest on a regular basis or go to meetings, that was up to you. But an individual wasn't, like, groups of people, you know, in the dorm, you know, recruiting people mm-hmm. to go out and go to meetings, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. No. Parties, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, we were all encouraged to go to parties, and only the boys' dorm could have beer parties. Mm-hmm. So we were, that's our freshman year. Then our sophomore year, as I had explained earlier, mm-hmm. Then it was our turn. The girls had were able to have beer parties. And so we were all looking, you know, we were all looking for dates, you know, we were all looking for guys and having fun and getting drunk and, you know, just going nuts. Mm-hmm. I mean, just really having a good time.
So did you feel freedom sexually, or did you feel confined to stigma on campus, or?
No, I felt free.
So what did the revolution mean to you in terms of a breaking away from your family's norms, or was it just a totally separate experience for you in college? Or on a larger scale, did it feel differently?
Well, going from not knowing anything to the dorm and going out with guys, it was just such an extreme. Mm-hmm. And you had to make that break. There was no more of a, for all of us, we weren't that girl that left, you know, mm-hmm. We saw our parents for what they were, mm-hmm. and their relationships. Because I studied history, it had a lot to do with the Catholic Church and the hypocrisy, and so I broke probably away from everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, everything.
So did you break away from your religion then at that point?
Or oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, can you talk more about the hypocrisy that you mentioned?
Sure. Well, you know, I forget which class it was. One of my history classes we were talking about. Oh, well, especially women's studies, but that was later. But freshman year, early on, we were discussing or learning about like I said, I can't remember the class, but I remember distinctly learning about the Catholic Church and popes and cardinals. I mean, the whole administrative, the Vatican, and having wives or mistresses or homosexual encounters, and so I was really taken aback. Mm-hmm. I was really taken aback because my father was just so Catholic, where my mother, she practiced, but she wasn't like that, like my dad. Mm-hmm. And so that was really hard. That was really very difficult for me then to see my father as someone who had been sucked in by the church, especially in Mexico, when I, you know, also in history, whatever history class I was taking, going through the Columbus's discovery of the Americas, and then the missionaries exploiting and terrorizing and killing the Indians. Mm-hmm. And so I knew my father didn't know much about that, and his, where he came from, they were just so religious. I mean, there wasn't anything that they did without being connected to the church in some way. That's how they lived, their lives, their culture, where my dad was from. My mother, completely different, but that was... So I had to really assess my views about my dad. And that was not easy.
So what about attitudes towards birth control at the time? With the newly invented pill?
Well, yeah, mm-hmm. And again, in the circles that I was in, my friends, there was no knowledge of birth control. Hmm. No knowledge, and same for the guys. I mean, we all, I guess, learned about condoms, but, you know, nobody bothered.
Hmm. So was this
at first? Yeah, at first.
What do you mean?
Well, freshman year, you know, no one bothered. We're just trying to teach ourselves, kind of, mm-hmm. you know, keep our heads above water here. And then nobody knew about STDs, and so again, you know, we had to make sure we. Paddled hard enough so that we could keep our heads above water knowledge-wise on what was going on and trying to stay ahead of the game so that we could have safe sex. And so it was really a matter of just finding friends who, you know, who were able to communicate, you know, what they were learning or where to get information, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And thank God for what was then called the People's Pharmacy, which is now Community Pharmacy,
okay.
off of State Street. And they were right over here on State, by State and Francis. Is that Francis, right? No, State and Lake. Not too far up between Francis and Lake. Mm. And they were in the basement, so that made it even more mysterious. And so by the time I met Dan my sophomore year, I was a little bit more knowledgeable. He was too. I think the guys, you know, were on top of the condom thing, but not really. I mean, it wasn't, that was like the automatic talk. It wasn't until you got into a relationship that you really discovered that. I think all three of us, my friend and my cousin and I, fortunately, we did get involved with somebody, and there was, you know, couple being able to learn together, mm-hmm. And so yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, what were ways you learned about safer sex practices if that wasn't being taught at the university?
Just word of mouth, and word of mouth definitely, and then our bodies ourselves.
Oh yeah,
that was it.
Wow. So nothing from university services like UW Health or anything? No?
No.
Oh. So,
they didn't seem to ask a whole lot of questions.
Okay.
And, you know, all of us were healthy, so mm-hmm. it was a little... And the pill. I did not know about the pill until maybe my spring semester of freshman year.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
So it wasn't talked about on campus much in your circles?
No. Not until after that. Hmm. Not until after Christmas break.
Mm-hmm.
Were people talking about that. I think freshman, you know, our fall semester was about not so much about sex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was out there trying to find a guy. But as my friend said, you know, it's kind of like we're the generation now of do-overs. We want a do-over.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were just so unprepared.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were just hit in the face with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because either you're pregnant or you're not. There isn't a gray area. We lawyers like to use that analogy a lot. Either you're a felon or you're not, you know. So we, you know, really did a lot of talking, and not just with women, but, you know, hopefully we chose a partner
mm-hmm.
that, you know, we could talk, with whom you could talk freely
mm-hmm.
about that.
So when the pill was introduced and you started learning more about it, what were attitudes like? Was it a good introduction, or were people indifferent?
Oh, people wanted it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. The pill was definitely, although all of us know of people who had an abortion,
mm-hmm.
You know, we definitely did not want to go that route if we could at all mm-hmm. possibly, you know, handle that, I mean, properly. And so it was good, you know. I mean, we all really try to help each other out. And I have to say, the pharmacy, community pharmacy, now called community pharmacy, they were really extremely helpful.
The pill was accessible at the time.
Yeah, I think, let me see. Well, for sure, in 1972 it was.
Mm-hmm. I see. So you mentioned abortion was that.
But I wasn't on the pill until I was married.
I see. So was there a similar stigma now toward abortion at the time, or was that just not spoken of? If there were a woman who were to get pregnant and chose not to.
No one ever talked about that.
I see.
But people did, you know, because this was pre Roe v. Wade, which was in January of 73, I think. And so when my cousin got pregnant, she went to, you know, student services, health services, and no one said a word to her.
Wow.
You know, no one about anything. I mean, it was all pretty closed. Unless you brought it up, people were not going to say very much. It was definitely positive. Like I said, we for being so Catholic, we all left that
mm-hmm.
at home.
Yeah. So now that women were able to experiment sexually and be more vocal just about their sexual freedom, do you think that applied to people in the LGBTQ community, or was it more just like a women-focused revolution?
There was no LGBT
community. People weren't out yet?
God, no.
Mm-hmm.
No. And the only time that I really came in contact with anybody who was gay at that time was through my brothers. My brothers were, I think both brothers mentioned that there were people in bathrooms on campus who were attacking other men.
Mm.
That was it. That was it. And so the guys really had to be careful about that. Really careful. And then my only other experience up until then was when I was working at the Department of Psychiatry, and there were quite a few. Quite a few people who were gay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so, I mean, and again, no one really talked about it, but they were out. I mean, they were very out.
Okay.
And it was great. Mm-hmm. I mean, they, you know, everybody treated everybody very well. At the Department of Psychiatry when I was a receptionist there.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. No, I couldn't have had a better, more positive experience.
That's great.
And so when I went back to school, then in the late 70s, I hung out at a room of one's own. And that there was a very strong then presence. Mm-hmm. And then in law school, there was a very... Then it was a community.
Okay.
And that was in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, until Room of One's Own, you know, there was nothing. I mean, that I could see. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see anything, you know, other, you know, until then.
Mm-hmm. Were there other changes you saw from when you came back to UW? In terms of just sexual freedom for women and anyone else, any other group?
It was pretty extremely out there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think the scene once you've graduated from college was happy hours and getting picked up. You know, then the term meat market came up, you know, and just terms like that, going to bars and getting picked up. Those were the two things that I remember quite distinctly, you know, going to happy hour and going to bars. Oh, and the Cardinal. Well, but that wasn't until the 80s that I started going to the Cardinal. And the owner, he was gay. I don't know if he's still alive, Ricardo. And then one of the psychiatry residents, his lover owned the Washington Hotel. And so we'd go there after the Cardinal. We'd walk back to the Washington Hotel. And then we started hearing things about the gay community. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't good.
Yeah.
It was not good. Going to discos in the late 70s and 80s, very, very fun, but there was, it was, I think there were a lot of problems, even as I heard from at a Room of One's Own, a lot of violence. Mm-hmm. Within the gay community, LGBTQ mm-hmm. Community, a lot of violence. Mm-hmm. And then we started hearing more about rapes on campus. There were always muggings, mm-hmm. and there were always rapes and kidnappings in the early, from I would say 67 on. There was a lot of that, mm-hmm. a lot of that. I heard a lot about that. So we had to be very careful. I joined Women's Transit mm-hmm. Authority so we could give women rides.
Oh.
You know, I always had a whistle.
Yeah.
And so then it turned more like not fun mm-hmm. anymore.
I see.
Even picking up people at bars. That could lead to a lot of really bad things.
Mm-hmm. Well, today there's still a lot of issues of sexual assault on campus here and everywhere. And there's a lot of talk about consent. And now it's in the national dialogue recently, but what was consent to you in the 1960s and 70s?
Just being there.
Just being there?
Yeah, pretty much. I didn't have problems in terms of saying no. Mm-hmm. And no one ever talked about that. Mm-hmm. I think that was another taboo. Because if you were there, you were part of the problem. And saying no, people kind of laughed about that. Oh. You were asking for it if you were there. That's pretty much the attitude mm-hmm. in the 70s. It then later on in the late 70s, I would say, in the 80s, it was much improved, but it was very, very difficult to change. I mean, even like being a lawyer in Kenosha and Racine, mm-hmm.
you know, there we were still, you know, objectified. Mm-hmm. They didn't want us in their firms. We certainly were not going to be a judge or a court commissioner. There were some women, but again, they, you know, there were women who were not glamorous. There were women who were cute and women who were glamorous and sexy. And you could kind of see where, you know, in Kenosha, everybody was had a label.
Hmm.
Everybody was labeled by guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes other women, but the men really, you know, you see it with Trump. That's why it's so agonizing. It's just so agonizing to me. I just want to end the pain of hearing him talk about people and women, because that's what we heard in the 80s even,
mm-hmm.
you know, as we were leaving law school, about everybody, white men, you know, just labeling everybody, and it wasn't in a good way.
How did that affect your work experience?
It was awful.
Mm.
It was really awful. I mean, I couldn't leave Legal Action. I mean, I went out on my own after 7 years,
mm-hmm.
but that was after I made a reputation for myself. But because I was doing poverty law, a lot of judges and other attorneys didn't like that. Number one, I'm a minority. Number two, I was doing poverty law. And trying to make it easy for minorities to get by, or, you know, to just to get by. I mean in a bad way, not in a good way. That we were, you know, taking advantage of taxpayers, basically.
Mm-hmm. So going back to your time at UW. This is my last question about this, unless you have anything else you'd like to add. But what about feminist groups on campus? Were you a part of any of those in terms
of
the revolution?
Oh, well, yeah. Then my undergraduate degree
mm-hmm.
was in women's studies, the program, mm-hmm. not the department.
Yeah.
And that was very helpful. I mean, I felt very safe.
Hmm.
I felt very safe. And it was wonderful. It was a really wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
Really wonderful, thank God, for that movement. But it had to come. I mean, there was just the violence against women on campus was extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget who I told. I think it was you. That, you know, when you asked about, I can't even remember the name for them. The overall ruling party or ruling governance of the dorms and student body,
mm-hmm.
they were non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't helpful. You couldn't run to them and say, this is what's going on. I mean, it just became just so bad that, you know, women had to do it on their own. I mean, students had to do it on their own, or postgraduates. And you could see the really... the level of pain and hurt on a lot of postgraduates trying to carve their way through the white male ruling party, ruling authorities here on campus. It was just so unpleasant to deal mm-hmm. with the establishment. So unpleasant. There was ridicule, there was, you know, neglect, totally being ignored, denial that we were on campus. It was incredible. It was an incredible time. I mean, it went from having fun to being really scared, really, really scared. And then after law school, then there was AIDS, and mm-hmm. then we were scared for a whole nother reason.
Yeah.
And so it was really very, very interesting, very interesting. I wish I had talked to my mother more about that on campus. And I don't know that for sure she wouldn't have talked to Teresa, but I could be wrong, my cousin.
Mm.
And, but yeah, I think my friend And we all had different experiences depending on what was going on in our home life too, because Teresa got married and had children, and she had a very difficult time, even though she had a supportive husband and he was a very good father. She still had a very difficult time, you know, because she was a nurse, which I see today in my practice with people going through nursing school. It is extremely demanding and unforgiving, and it is not a family-friendly profession. They, as you know, we're talking about doctors now and cutting down and on their workload and getting more sleep, that kind of thing. Well, that was really true for Teresa and going through the master's program and becoming a nurse. She found that very difficult. But for the three of us, there wasn't any way that we were going to talk to our families about any of this. No way. Mm-hmm. My mother didn't have children when she went, you know, through school here. She got married afterwards. My dad waited, and for her to graduate from her with her master's, and then they got married and had a family. And I think a lot of it too is the expectations. We really rebelled against that. Again, it was the overall anti-establishment.
Yeah.
Sort of situation, you know, the materialism that went along with having a family. So, in contrast, I think, you know, I'm finding different groups of people, now that it's my 50th class reunion from high school, the women who didn't go away to college and didn't go to college and their families and where they are today, versus the women who did go to college and where they are today. And then the people who were in communes and where they are today. I did not really see the existence of a commune here. I kind of relate that to more of a West Coast kind of phenomena, so to speak. But one of my classmates, apparently high school classmates, she did create her own commune, and I really want to talk to her more at length about that. I mean, that was really an extreme where you were rejecting everything and going off on your own. Here on campus, we had our own happy family, and so we felt secure with that. And I never wanted to leave Madison ever because this was, you know, where I was the happiest and more or less accepted.
Mm-hmm.
So going, you know, I still have nightmares about leaving. And especially because my apartment was on Mifflin Street, West Mifflin Street. I still, you know, that was just, a good time. Both when I was married, we lived there. And then afterwards, and Dan left and I stayed after we were divorced. And then I went back to school. But yeah, right now my friends consist of women who primarily did not go to college, or if they did, they didn't go very far in college, and then started having families. But they still felt the same kind of revolution against their parents. Because they wanted to do things their own way and not have all of the expectations of, you know, that generation, I guess they're called, the Tom Brokaw coined them as the greatest generation. Yeah, those people. And then to find out that the Beat generation was actually my mother's age group really blew me away, because they kind of started it all, and Jack Kerouac, and finding out about it. But again, we're talking about mostly men, a couple of women, and their lifestyles, not attractive, I mean, there was a lot of drinking, not that there wasn't here, because there was a lot of then marijuana here. But, I think, I know a young woman who is really having a huge problem with having heavy periods and painful periods. And she is not able to find any relief. And that shocked me quite a bit, because mm-hmm. that's been around for a long time,
yeah.
and we haven't gotten any further.
Yeah,
that is very, very shocking. When I would get my period, I would go to, Dan would take me to the emergency room, because it was, because I was in so much pain, and it's still that way, and I just don't understand.
Yeah,
it was very enlightening. And the thing is about talking and sharing, where the guys apparently didn't that much, is that was our way to protect ourselves too. We were able to, most of us, come away not too damaged and banged up.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just a do-over, and totally didn't expect what was going to happen mm-hmm. to us.
So now looking back and looking at where women are now in terms of progress, what are your observations from your time at college versus young women at college now?
I think because I do a lot of divorce work and I have for the last 35 years, I see that women are still having a very young women who, even if they've gone to school, even if they have a profession, if they're in divorce court, they are having a very difficult time, very, very difficult time. And I think still that there are a lot of women who find themselves in either custody court or divorce court because they can't strike a good balance between being a mom, being a professional, or, I mean, not a professional, even just working two jobs or whatever, and having a family, I mean, let alone a husband.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, I think for women, there's still very, there's not a good balance for many women. Now, my niece and her friends, the people not in divorce court, custody mm-hmm. court, the guys are definitely participating more. But that also means then that social organizations like the Optimist and the Rotary Club in Racine,
mm.
although the Rotary is everywhere, they're not able to do the kinds of community work anymore, because the younger guys are home with the kids and helping out. That happened, I think, in the mid-90s when I joined Rotary after about 5 or 6 years. They were recruiting more younger men, because it was pretty old when I was recruited to be a member. All these old guys eating their steak lunches every single week and not talking. They didn't talk. But they were really good organizers, and they really did a lot of stuff for the community. The younger guys, they didn't want to have steak. They wanted more vegetables, and they didn't want to spend as much time doing community work, because they had their, you know, families to mm-hmm. consider. Extreme difference. I mean, it was very, very interesting, very interesting. But I do think some of that imbalance goes to guys now too.
Mm-hmm.
They just get an easier break at paternity leave. It's like, wow, that just came really easy for them, didn't it? and some of the other breaks. But I do see a lot of women being held back because of their families. And if they don't have somebody else supporting them, you know, either the father or other family members, they are held back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, they, I just don't see it any other way. They really do need the support,
mm-hmm.
if they're going to go on. But especially in nursing school, that's very unforgiving. Very unforgiving. Because you have to be there for your internships. You cannot work, much less, you know, work and then have family and go to school.
Yeah.
That's not doable. Mm-hmm. I think that young, you know, women under the age of 50 have better relationships with the men in their lives, a lot better,
mm-hmm.
and they seem to be more supportive. We're still over 50, not so much. You know, it's still pretty much the woman taking, doing the work,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
trying to find the balance, and guys having to be dragged into that world. But yeah, I do think it's easier in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you know, unfortunately, as a lawyer, I see that other side.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to be around my niece and her friends where the men are really there.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to shirk from their responsibilities. So it's kind of a extreme, if you ask me, mm-hmm. really extreme from what I see in my life, you know, going on. But, and then on campus, what was it really interesting, and when I was working, too, for the Department of Psychiatry, women supporting their husbands through medical school, mm-hmm. and then living in the married dorms, and having children and supporting their husbands.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty extreme. That was really extreme. I think that was mostly for graduate students and not so much undergrads. It was very rare that anybody in undergraduate school is married, okay. but a lot of guys were married in graduate school or medical school. And by the time they were doing their residencies, and I was a receptionist there at the Department of Psychiatry, most of the guys were married.
Hmm.
Most of them were married. I can't think of anybody except the gay guys. I mean, but even still, they had their partners.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody thought anything different about their partners.
Hmm.
And as a matter of fact, Lorna Benjamin, she was a psychology resident, and her partner, you know, was calling all the time. I knew who she was, and Lisa, and then she became a psych resident, you know, in the department, and like, oh, okay, yeah, I know you, kind of thing. You call all the time. So, I mean, it was just, you know, a big, gigantic family, and it was very cool. And I think they even had kids. Lorna, I think, had kids.
Mm.
And so it was, like I said, it was a very, very helpful experience, mm. wonderful experience being part of that group. But on the heterosexual side, the guys were just, man, there were problems there with women. They too. But at least they would talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had to talk about it, so they would talk about it. Mm-hmm. So again, I was used to that. What coming out of there, I was used to have knowing men who would talk about things.
Mm-hmm.
But in the real world, no, that doesn't happen. My age group.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Kind of, you know, it's kind of an interesting discussion with my cousin and my friend. Because when I first said, well, you know, I'm going to do this interview and blah, 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 but, you know, what kind of insights do you have? And so, oh, you'll have to ask Jay about that, you know, because, again, it was the guys.
Yeah.
You know. But then later on I said, oh, come on now, you know.
Yeah.
We were together, you know, for him and him and him. And oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, it went from fun to scary. Pretty quickly.
Wow.
We had a really grow up in that fashion.
I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah. And there really wasn't a whole lot of talk about STDs. There were a lot of jokes. And then, you know, I was trying to figure that out. And again, you go back to our bodies, ourselves. And then there was a joy of sex. But I think if you had a partner, you know, who was going to stick around, it was a good thing. It was a really good thing. It was a really good thing.
Yeah. Was there anything else?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, my friend said that what stuck out in her mind was the fact that we were taught to have expectations of love with sex, that you were in love. If somebody wanted to have sex with you and, you know, you were into it, you know, that was a whole big, you were in love kind of situation. And she said, no, that wouldn't be the case. I mean.
So you'd only be intimate with someone that you loved
at the time? Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, most. I mean, later on, no. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're going to bars and. No, then that's just out and out, one night stands.
Mm-hmm.
But early on, yeah, if you were going to have that kind of relationship with somebody and you were going to have sex, yeah, you know, it was automatically you weren't going to do it unless you loved the person. Or just having sex meant love.
Yeah.
I think that's what she meant.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And she's right about that. A lot of us really did think, you know, this is love.
Mm-hmm.
Even into the one-night stands. I mean, that was very easy for women to flip into, but guys, no. And then we're talking about our brothers and the objectification of women, you know, they at work, in school, and ranking women and rating them, and men having apartments just for sex away from the family so they wouldn't know, or going to certain hotels. Yeah, it was crazy. You know, we didn't have that. Well, we didn't have any money, but we didn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just so dependent on our parents that we weren't going to wreck that either.
Yeah.
Yeah, it comes down to a lot of economics for us, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I'm trying to think, Teresa, my cousin, we were comparing our husbands, and I said, no, there's no way I would ever want to have a child with him. And she said, oh, yeah, you know, Bill was really there for me. And very, very different attitudes.
You see.
On having children then. But I would, you know, I am dying to find out from my classmate, high school classmate, what it was like to be in a commune.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I do know, oh, wait, I had a friendship with a classmate, too, who was always what we would call on the make in high school with girls. And, you know, no, I would never, I told him I had a 6-month relationship with this one guy because he didn't know, because it's a big school. And he said, 6 months? I maybe had 6-day relationship with someone, not 6 months. And for him, it was always sex, sex, sex. I mean, he was very open about discussing that all the way through college. There was no way he was going to be tied down. Again, tied down in quotes, as guys would say. That wasn't going to happen with him. He was, and the guys kind of promoted that. They kind of lived through certain men that way. But I did not know that Judy's brothers and friends went that far as to have, you know a hotel and have apartments and, here on campus, it would be crashing. That was in Racine. And here on campus, guys would just crash, you know, at somebody's, you know, some woman's house, and stay there, sometimes unwelcome, and just be, have one endless party after the other. And I'm trying to think here. That's pretty much what they stood out. What stood out for them?
Sure.
All three of us really had different experiences depending on, you know, our family, our families, and I think that's what really made the difference for us was our families. Not even the church, because we're all Catholic, but yeah, our families made the difference on how things turned out.
Was there anything else?
I don't think so. Probably come up with something else later, but no.
You can. But thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.